Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Neanderthals Rediscovered, How Modern Science is Rewriting Their Story, revised and updated edition, by Dimitra Papayani and Michael A. Morse, narrated by Nigel Patterson. Preface. Late one warm summer night in 2007, Mike drove from the John Radcliffe Hospital, Oxford, to our home in a village outside the city and turned on the computer. His task was to tell friends and family the good news that Dimitra had just given birth to twins and that all three of them were doing fine. When he opened his email, there was a new message from Thames and Hudson. It seemed that our Neanderthal book proposal had been accepted. The question was, with newborn twins, how could we now find time to write it? We had no way of knowing it then, but this was a lucky coincidence. Had we met the original September 2008 contractual deadline, the book would have been immediately obsolete. The pace of new discoveries has been staggering. For example, when we started writing Chapter 2 on the human colonization of Europe, the accepted time of arrival was 800,000 years ago. By the time we had finished the first draft, some weeks later, it was 1.2 million years ago. In another case, a new discovery in Kenya set a new age record for hand axe tool technology at 1.76 million years ago. It was not just new discoveries, but the development of new technologies that brought about the greatest changes. The most startling news came in 2010, by which point we had put the writing on hold in order to move the family across the ocean to America. We'd like to think that this makes the book the ultimate Thames and Hudson publication, because we started it close to one river and finished it a few miles from the other. Had we submitted the book before this announcement, we would have missed out on a crucial line of evidence from the emerging field of paleogenetics. The idea for this book dates back much earlier, some 20 years before the current golden age of discovery, to our student days. Dimitra, who once excavated royal Roman tombs in Cyprus, explained why she spent so much time studying stone tools from 100,000 years ago, when the earth still held untold secrets. Hidden cities buried by desert sands, Egyptian tombs, cave paintings. She said that her work was the most interesting of all, for ultimately she was exploring what it means to be human. Mike, who studied archaeology as a historian of science, slowly became drawn into this field, which goes by the misleadingly boring name of Middle Paleolithic Archaeology. Eventually, we felt that we could combine our skills to write something that neither of us could do alone. Dimitra remains the real archaeologist in this endeavour, while Mike helped to shape the narrative. Dimitra's connection to the Neanderthals goes back much earlier. In Chapter 5, we discuss the Neanderthal site of Kokinopilos in Greece, and a Nazi guard post that stands atop it. The historian Mark Mazower mentions the survival of such guard posts in his book Inside Hitler's Greece, 1993, where he also describes a massacre by the Nazis in the nearby village of Kuklesi, carried out in revenge for an attack by the resistance. One of the victims of this massacre was a teenage boy named Dimitrios, who was not in the resistance, but who had the bad luck to be caught wearing a shirt that was made in Britain, casting suspicion on him. Years later, Dimitrios's brother, Anastasios, was asked by friends in the nearby village of Risovouni to become godfather to their newborn daughter. Anastasios agreed, and according to tradition, was able to name the child. He named her after his murdered brother, choosing the female version of the name. Dimitra later became involved with a Cambridge project in the region and ended up writing her PhD dissertation on the stone tools of Kokinopilos, a short distance from her village, and other red bed sites in the region. The greatest lesson we have learned from studying the Neanderthals is not to demean them. When we tell friends about this project, they often say something sarcastic like, "I know a few Neanderthals you might include in the book." We'll only know we succeeded if people start to show the Neanderthals some deserved respect. They were accomplished humans, too. Plus, it's cowardly. If you had made fun of them directly to their chinless faces, they might have torn your arms off. Our main motivation for writing this book, however, has been our conviction that the Neanderthal story is a compelling one, one that has not previously been told in its entire dramatic arc, from origins to expansion to demise. Most books with the word Neanderthal in the title seem to collapse the species into an ahistorical list of features and important sites before morphing into a book on the species that replaced them. We wanted to write a book on the Neanderthals that does not dwell too much on the false turns in the long history of research and does not get easily distracted by the entry of Homo sapiens onto the scene. In short, we envisioned a book on the Neanderthals that is fairly exclusively about the Neanderthals. The need for a book like this became apparent when Dimitra started teaching a course called The Neanderthal World in various university continuing education programs. Her course was unusual in that it looked at human evolution from the Neanderthal point of view, and she discovered that it was immensely popular. Students kept asking her to recommend a book, and she realized there was no good single source on the Neanderthals. The most comprehensive book was In Search of the Neanderthals by Chris Stringer and Clive Gamble. Published back in 1993, this was becoming out of date and did not have anything on the exciting new discoveries. While there are many good books to recommend that touch on the topic, we wanted to bring all the threads of the Neanderthal story together in one place. We think the rise and fall of the Neanderthals is one of the greatest stories from the prehistoric past. After more than 150 years of archaeological discovery, the Neanderthals are the best-known human species other than ourselves. They are the one most closely related to us, and they coexisted with us quite recently. For the last Neanderthals, the earliest modern human art in Europe may have been thousands of years old already. For all these reasons, we had long wanted to share our fascination with them. It was just a matter of timing. And given how much more we know now than we knew when we started this journey, we hope you'll agree that the best time is, in fact, now. It is impossible to write about a million years of prehistory, including sites from Western Europe to Central Asia, and about fields as disparate as biological anthropology, genetics, geology, and archaeology, without tremendous help. We are indebted to our many friends and colleagues who have helped guide our thinking. This book could not have been written without them. At the same time, we have presented the Neanderthal story through the filter of our own idiosyncratic choices, and responsibility for those, and indeed any mistakes, is ours alone. We would particularly like to thank Mircea Angelinu, Nick Ashton, Jill Cook, Clive Gamble, Ivor Karavanic, Mark Lamster, Paul Pettit, Nelly Foka Cosmetatu, Matt Pope, Vil Raybrooks, Antonio Rosas, Catherine Scott, Chris Stringer, Aaron Stutz, Carolyn Smith, and Carol Watkin. Our editor, Colin Ridler at Thames and Hudson, played a very large role in shaping the book, and we owe him a huge debt of gratitude. Sincere thanks are also due to the rest of the team there: Kim Richardson, Louise Thomas, Sarah Vernon Hunt, Aaron Hayden, Terry Martin, Celia Falconer, and Steve Russell. A key aspect of Neanderthal research is reconsidering what it means to be human. As we were delving into the human past to answer this question, we were also becoming intimately familiar with a different kind of human mind, the autistic one, within our own family. For teaching us the true essence of humanity and for being a constant source of joy, we dedicate this book to the boys who were born the same night that Thames and Hudson gave the project the green light, and to their sister, who has become at least as enthusiastic about the Neanderthals as we are. Chapter 1. A Long Underestimated Type of Human. From our perspective as Homo sapiens, it can be tempting to look back on human evolution with a sense of triumph and destiny. With our large brains, crafty hands, agile legs, and complex social networks, it was surely inevitable that when the conditions became favourable, we would assume our rightful place at the very pinnacle of nature. But perhaps it is a little too easy to claim this now that we have no serious rivals, and certainly no human ones. We are only one variety, modern humans, of up to a dozen human species that have shared our world in the last 2 million years or so. And our direct ancestors were not always in the leading position. If we could rewind the clock to the last time the world was as warm and stable as it is today, some 120,000 mostly icy and climatically erratic years ago, we would probably not feel as privileged as we do now. Back then, the Neanderthals, a species much like us, only stronger, were on the march. With unprecedented abilities to survive cold climates, this rival species might have been the prime candidate to populate the whole Earth from its origin point in Europe and push other forms of human to extinction. Over some tens of thousands of years from that point, the weather deteriorated, and enormous ice sheets advanced in the northern latitudes. Somehow, the particular human species native to Europe managed to survive these hardships, while our ancestors faced warmer challenges in Africa and later tropical Asia. Fast forward to about 45,000 years ago, when modern humans first ventured into a Europe half covered by glaciers. There, they encountered a form of human that, unlike themselves, had already lived through several cold episodes. Yet it was the warm-adapted Homo sapiens that survived this most recent glacial cycle. The cold-adapted Neanderthals failed, dying out in the millennia after our ancestors arrived in their homeland. The species equivalent of our first cousins, the Neanderthals were unmistakably different from modern humans, with large, barrel-shaped chests, stocky and muscular bodies, broad noses, and chins that did not protrude. They shared many of our behaviours, but their development seemed to trail ours in some key areas, such as our capacity for symbolic expression. Even their world was alien to ours. The open, steppe-like landscapes that prevailed in Europe in their heyday enjoyed good exposure to sunlight and had rich vegetation that sustained sizable populations of mammoth, bison, deer, and horse, species essential to the Neanderthal diet. Neanderthal landscapes were unlike the barren steppes of present-day Eurasia, or indeed any landscapes anywhere in today's world. The Neanderthals are the only native European species in the human family tree, and this alone has fostered an enduring fascination with them. Europe has a much longer history of archaeological investigation and research, and therefore a richer record of its distant past than any other part of the world. We have known them longer, since we discovered them in the 19th century, than any other extinct form of human. And because Neanderthals are a relatively recent species, their fossilized bones, the remains of their everyday lives, and even their DNA are well preserved. The Neanderthals are not just one of our closest relatives, they are also the ones we know best. With Neanderthals, we are as close as we will ever get to another species from the human evolutionary past. Like so many people who are different from us, the Neanderthals are now known mainly for the use of their name as a pejorative. In this book, we do not pretend to be able to correct this popular usage, but we do hope to restore some dignity to those we replaced. The Neanderthals have always been a little too close for comfort for the modern Western world. Their name conjures up images of muscular but dim-witted cavemen who relied on force over cunning. When a New York Times arts critic recently wrote about Neanderthal TV, he was referring not to a documentary on human evolution, but to programs that feature deeply flawed male characters with antisocial tendencies. The name can also be a source of humor. A rock band called the Neanderthals dresses in animal skins and sings simplistic songs about girls. We think this is all unfair. Too often, the Neanderthal story is told simply as a backdrop to our own, a reflection of the same obsession with our own species found in our creation stories. Yet there is a gentle countercurrent to this sapiens centrism, a growing sense of collective guilt that appears in the most unlikely places. We once came across a bottle cap that, for no clear reason, declared, "The brain of Neanderthal man was larger than that of modern man." It was a reminder that, of all the large mammal species whose extinction we have witnessed in recent millennia, at least one seems to have been our equal in brain capacity, if not in humanity. In recent years, new research has pulled the Neanderthals much closer to us. Not only did they have brains as large as ours, though their skulls had a different, flatter shape, they also buried their dead, cared for the disabled, hunted animals in their prime, used a form of spoken language, and even lived in some of the same places as the modern humans, who were, broadly speaking, their contemporaries. They could not have survived, even in warmer times, had they not mastered fire and worn clothes. Though they relied heavily on meat, they consumed seeds and plants, including herbs, and could fish and harvest seafood. These are all behaviours that at some point were thought to be exclusive to ourselves. A golden age of research. The pace of progress in our understanding of the Neanderthals keeps accelerating. Thanks to some breathtaking recent discoveries and scientific advances, we can now examine the story of the Neanderthals in greater depth than was previously thought possible. This is truly the golden age of Neanderthal research, making it the perfect time to see how all the strands of evidence fit together into a narrative of the rise and fall of a long underestimated type of human. When we started studying the Neanderthals in the early 1990s as graduate students, much of what is now our current knowledge was the subject of heated debate. Most of this debate revolved around the Neanderthals' role in our own story. In those days, for example, it was not yet clear whether the Neanderthals and modern humans ever shared the same continent at the same time. We now know they did. Archaeologists were then still absorbing the implications of a genetic study that supported the so-called out-of-Africa theory, that all living modern humans can be traced back genetically to a single woman, or a small group of women, in sub-Saharan Africa. The entry of genetic evidence into archaeology exposed sharp divisions in the discipline. Although the out-of-Africa theory was about the evolutionary trajectories of all modern human populations, Europe and the Neanderthals were a key part of the debate. The dominant question in Neanderthal research at the time was whether they were part of our evolutionary ancestry or whether they had been replaced, either after a hiatus or by being outcompeted, perhaps even killed off, by modern humans who had originated in Africa and migrated into Europe. In 1993, Chris Stringer and Clive Gamble published their landmark volume In Search of the Neanderthals, which put forward the case that modern humans replaced rather than evolved from the Neanderthals. Little did we realise that this was just the beginning of a wave of new insights and evidence about our evolutionary kin, and that the question of our replacement of the Neanderthals would re-emerge forcibly with further genetic studies. Since then, there have been several major news stories every year on the Neanderthals. Atapuerca, a cave network in Spain, has produced the remains of around 30 individual proto-Neanderthals, an astonishing total if we consider that the number of Neanderthal individuals in the fossil record is only a few hundred. In 2007, a discovery from a different part of Atapuerca pushed definitive evidence for the earliest occupation of Europe, possibly by a Neanderthal predecessor species, over the 1 million-year mark for the first time. And more recently, a team in Germany led by Svante Paabo has made staggering claims based on the identification of Neanderthal DNA. It can be hard at times to make sense of this flood of information. The number of scientific disciplines contributing to Neanderthal research in recent years has multiplied. Our knowledge has been boosted by a variety of specialists. Geologists who drill sediments from the deep ocean floor and take ice cores from glaciers covering Greenland and Antarctica. Archaeologists who sieve and sort through every ounce of dirt from an excavation, looking for anything from seeds to rodent teeth. Geneticists who put on sterile clothing to drill Neanderthal bones in the hope of finding bits that have neither fossilized nor been contaminated by flakes of their own skin in order to extract ancient DNA. And of course, those archaeology students who kneel down with a trowel and brush to excavate squares of earth, layer by layer, carefully recording the location of every stone, tool or bone they might find, and hoping they aren't embarrassed by confusing the two. We now know more than we ever thought we could about the Neanderthals and their world. They have emerged as more accomplished in their everyday lives and more complex in their social behaviour than we imagined. This makes it all the more puzzling why this separate form of human, nearly as advanced biologically and culturally as ourselves, became extinct. The fate of the Neanderthals has been a mystery for more than 150 years. The Valley of the New Man. But before we consider the Neanderthals' fate, let us explore their discovery. There is a satisfying irony in the fact that we discovered our former human rivals in the course of supplying the energy and materials for global domination. It is no exaggeration to say that our knowledge of the Neanderthals was an unexpected byproduct of industrial mining in the 19th century. As engineers were digging ever deeper for minerals, evidence was fast accumulating about the Earth's past. There will be very soon little left to discover, was how the Times of London described the science of geology in 1863. The occasion was the British Association for the Advancement of Sciences annual summer meeting in Newcastle. The conference was enormous, with scores of mineralogists, geologists, chemists, and others from dozens of burgeoning scientific disciplines. It was here that a little-known professor called William King became the first person to use fossil evidence to name an extinct species closely related to our own. The conference's keynote speaker was Sir William Armstrong, a local industrialist and engineer. In celebrating the fast pace of discovery, he noted that in short order Charles Darwin had finished On the Origin of Species, John Speke and James Grant had found the source of the Nile, and Charles Lyell had published Geological Evidences of the Antiquity of Man, which extended human history deep into the past. One of Lyell's protégés, Professor King had come to the meeting from Queen's College Galway in Ireland to present a short paper on a recent discovery from a lime quarry near Dusseldorf in what was then Prussia. Some 16 years earlier, he had been forced out of his job as curator of the Newcastle Museum. Now he hoped to return in triumph. In his paper, King discussed human-like bones that had turned up in a cave, Feldhofer, in the Neander Valley 7 years earlier. The collection included ribs, arm and leg bones, and the top of a skull that featured a protruding crest above the eyes. In a departure from the prevailing view that the bones belonged to a deformed member of our own species, King argued that they dated to the glacial period and were closer to the chimpanzee than to any modern human. We now know that King was wrong on this last point, for the individuals from the Neander Valley were much closer to modern humans than chimpanzees. But he was correct in his more startling conclusion when he argued that they were fundamentally different from all living humans. He proposed to distinguish the species by the name Homo neanderthalensis after the Neander Valley where they were discovered. In the process, he unwittingly immortalized a 17th-century psalmist, Joachim Neumann. Following the Philhellenic fashions of the 19th century, Neumann's last name, literally new man, was translated to the Greek Neander and then attached to the valley, Tal in German, where he penned his psalms. Thanks to King, members of the long-extinct species unearthed there have been known by the wonderfully ironic name of Neanderthals, people from the Valley of the New Man. Before that day, the nearest known species to humans were living apes. Today, there are more than 20 named species in our family tree since the split from the apes, and with recent discoveries such as Homo floresiensis, the so-called hobbit, in Indonesia in 2003, and the Denisovans from Siberia, whose genes were identified in 2010, it seems likely that this number will continue to increase. Before the discovery in the Neander Valley in 1856, other Neanderthal remains, a small child's skull from Angers, Belgium in 1829, and an adult skull from Gibraltar in 1848, had been unearthed, but they had not been recognised as a distinct species. Additional bones appeared in the ensuing decades, notably from Spee, Belgium, in the 1880s. Yet the Neanderthals lingered on the margins of the human evolutionary story, even as other species, such as Homo erectus, in its guises as Java man, discovered at Trinil, Indonesia, in the 1890s, and Peking man, discovered at Zhoukoudien, China, in the 1920s and 1930s, quickly acquired the label of missing link between ourselves and the apes. Today, evidence of Neanderthal occupation extends from Wales all the way to Siberia. In this book, we trace the evolution of the Neanderthals in Europe, their expansion into Asia, and their ultimate encounter with our own ancestors. Each successive chapter moves us closer to the present and covers smaller and smaller chunks of time. This is not because the distant past necessarily contained fewer noteworthy developments, though change seems to have occurred more slowly then, but because the evidence of more recent times is better preserved. New questions. With all the recent advances in Neanderthal research, there are new, intriguing, and sometimes unexpected questions. In addition, things we thought we knew, like scientific dates, are sometimes overturned in the light of new evidence. In each stage of Neanderthal evolution, and in every chapter in this book, there are questions to which we do not have definitive answers. But we can now at least make reasonable attempts to answer them. Part of the enjoyment for us, and we hope for you, is to use the available evidence to put together a plausible story. We start around 1 million years ago with the first human entry into Europe, which would ultimately become the Neanderthal homeland. Who were Europe's first colonizers, and why did it take so long for them to get there, when humans had gone from Africa to Southeast Asia almost 1 million years earlier? Intriguingly, this pattern is mirrored much more recently by modern humans, who also reached Southeast Asia before Europe. Did they arrive in Europe from Africa or Asia? How successful was this first wave? While Europe has been inhabited by human species since around 1 million years ago, it was only by 500,000 years ago that incipient Neanderthal traits first appeared. Was this a case of local evolution, or did a new group arrive? The Europeans at that time used the same primary stone tool, the hand axe, that was favoured by people throughout Africa and much of Asia. What led the Europeans to take a different evolutionary path from their neighbours when they had so much in common? Neanderthals took on a distinctive form by 250,000 years ago. As their bones became unmistakably Neanderthal, their stone tools changed, and in a sense their technology improved. Instead of the large, unwieldy hand axe, they started using lighter, pocket-sized stone tools with long, sharp edges. The biggest mystery about this new kind of cutting tool is why it appeared almost simultaneously in at least three locations: Europe, Western Asia, and Southern Africa. Does this indicate some form of contact between early Neanderthals in Europe and the ancestors of modern humans in Africa, or are lightweight, versatile stone tools an inevitable outcome of larger brains? This begs the question of why Europeans and Africans, apparently in parallel, were both evolving larger brains. A sustained warm period that began some 130,000 years before the present enabled Neanderthals and modern humans to expand simultaneously from their separate homelands, ending the era of isolation in which they had evolved into separate species. We follow the convention of calling them separate species on the grounds of the differences in the shapes of their bones, and not because of any opinion as to their ability to reproduce successfully together. As the two human lines spread into Asia, it was not yet clear which of them was better positioned to take advantage of the opportunity to increase their population size. At the time, there were perhaps 4 or 5 distinct types of human. To us, the world feels small. With modern transportation, we can reach almost any destination within 24 hours. How did our little planet come to support so many different forms of humanity? Clutching very similar stone tools, Homo neanderthalensis and Homo sapiens were the prime contenders to dominate the Earth, coming out of Europe and Africa, respectively. It is unclear which human species were in Asia at this time, whether Homo erectus still survived in East Asia, or if the recently discovered dwarf human species, Homo floresiensis, possibly an even more archaic species, was then living on the island of Flores in modern Indonesia. There may also have been another group, tentatively called Denisovans, in Asia. How close was the Earth to becoming a Neanderthal world? The safe money was on the Neanderthals emerging as masters of the planet. They were far stronger than the other species. They had survived the kind of cold conditions that were making life increasingly difficult for everybody, and their brains were large. Modern humans were contenders, but were physically much weaker than the Neanderthals, and had no chance in straight combat. The only tiny advantage we know that Homo sapiens had was that it had started producing jewellery with little beads and shells, and the Neanderthals had not. The significance of this would later become clear. Modern humans and Neanderthals both reached the Near East sometime after 130,000 years ago. This was one of the most interesting moments in prehistory, as two human species roamed over the same territory. There is much we do not know about that epoch, starting with the question of whether the two species were there at the same time, whether they encountered each other, and indeed, if they interbred. What we do know is that this is close to the time when modern humans began to establish themselves as masters of the planet. But Neanderthals were also increasingly successful, reaching deeper into Asia. Everything changed for the Neanderthals by around 40,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens penetrated deep into their European homeland. This was the beginning of the end for a proud species of human. But how did they fail? Did they go quietly, retreating and dwindling away? Were they hostile, or did they welcome the new arrivals? And how did we emerge?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?